Today's podcast, skeptical Slavs and all of that, we're just going to be talking on the theme of manipulation. It's a very interesting subject, and we're going to kind of split it between personal manipulation, and also we're going to touch on media manipulation. And what we want to do is just look at all of the principles, techniques, and strategies of manipulating people, because it's very, well, interesting. So are we good so far?
Yep.
Okay. So I suppose I want to start by the personal manipulation techniques. We're going to talk interchangeably. Most of the time, we're just going to cover a subject and maybe give some few interesting examples per subject. So considering the personal manipulation, the first technique that I want to talk about is triangulation. Have you heard of it, maybe?
No, it sounds interesting.
it is interesting. So this is a manipulation that allegedly, I wouldn't say psychopaths, but people that really want, that have an agenda use. It's a technique used between two people. It's when I want something from you, whether that's a business arrangement, whether that's a romantic relationship or whatever. So what I do is I'm going to interact with you. I'm going to take you out on a date, wherever it may be. And so this is the first spot on the triangle. And the triangle goes 90 degrees vertically up. So I'm going to give you the best time of your life. Okay, I'm going to take the person out to some incredible event. I'm going to be caring. I'm going to present myself as if I am working in their interests 100%. And after I do all this and the person is left feeling, wow, what a great interaction, what a great companionship, what a great person this is, I'm going to go silent. So this is when the triangle drops down again to zero. So I'm not going to call, I'm not going to text, I'm not going to do anything. I'm just going to leave it out for you to decide how you want to move forward. This is also called diplomatic silence. Just okay. The part when I go dark, when I go silent. And this is used for me to get the message across, to inflate my price in a way. To make my significance more than it is. So I'm trying to increase my value by not interacting with you anymore, just so you start to miss me, if that makes any sense.
Sure.
Okay, so this is, one example of this is just dating. When you're
was the triangle? So there's three parts, right? Or...
No, it's just like shaped like a little pyramid. First, you go up, you're the best of the best, and then you just go down. You're dark.
Oh, okay.
Just,
so like
just
a,
don't
okay.
talk.
I see.
It's
I
total
see.
Radio silence.
Like okay.
So if you were to be interacting with a real friend, in quotes, even after the great event, you would still have some communication. You would be like, hey, what's up? Maybe I'm busy. Maybe I'll call you back later. But this is different. This is the person going totally dark.
But they're, why?
They could even. Because they want you to beg for it.
So does this work? Is that why this is well known?
It's not well known, but it does work. It works. It works a lot, especially in relationships. So when you want to impress somebody, you just show them the best that you can be, and then you go dark. It's like I'm not gonna call you anymore. I'm not gonna interact with you anymore. Even if you call, maybe I'll pick up, maybe I won't. I'll do it on my own terms.
But this can't work in an actual relationship. Maybe like the precursor to a relationship, or when you want to establish one, I guess. Because if you're actually in a relationship and you go dark, that's really shitty.
Actually, no. It's okay. The precursor to a relationship, yeah, in the dating phase, okay. That's one way to do it. But actually, in the relationship, when you want to reaffirm your position of authority, you can do that again. It's like reminding the person of who you are.
Sure, but when you're actually in a relationship, you can just communicate and say, like, you know, you shouldn't take me for granted, etc. You don't have to be like, oh, I'm gonna do radio silence now and not to talk to you for a few days. That's not the way you would do it, because you can't do that at the beginning of a relationship.
I'm not talking about pleasant techniques here. This isn't a good thing. But it does work. It's kind of like an ultimatum. You know, if you are both rational parties, you should be able to sit down, have a conversation, and sort your things out. But if you are doing a sort of an ultimatum with silence, then you are just testing the person to see if they can function or if they would like to function without you. So that's your position of power, I would argue. So this isn't a pleasant thing. I'm not quoting this technique as something that good people do, but it does work. And I've kind of seen it work for a few times. It's like you go silent for a while, and after a month or two, you know, the girl's gonna call back and she's gonna be like, "Oh, I miss you. What happened? Where did you go? Why did you disappear?"
Yeah, but like, what is the success rate on that thing? Because it might not be 100%.
It's not like I have a study in front of me. Come on.
No. But I'm saying, like, even if you tried five times, like, is it going to work 5 out of 5? If it works like 2 out of 5 times, I wouldn't say it's very useful, because you would lose half the people like that. And that doesn't seem like a very...
The argument is, and this is kind of like the argument, like, stop wasting my time. So if I do that to somebody, whether it's a business partner or whether it's a romantic affair, so if I go silent and after a while I don't get a response, I'm still counting that as a win in quotes, because I have just gotten feedback from that person that they don't need me anyway. And if I were to keep being a tryhard, and if I were to keep pushing for, you know, getting better with them, I would either end up negotiating a lower deal, or I would either end up in some similar situation like the friend zone. So that's why it's considered a win, even if they don't call back. So you're just saying, okay, well, you know, they didn't call back, so I can just move on now. And you move on.
Yeah, I understand it, but I definitely think this can only be done at the beginning of some relationship, because as you said, like, you're not gonna do this to your friends, and you sure as hell not gonna do to someone you're dating for a few months. You can't just, like, out of the blue.
You would be surprised how effective it is, even in relationships.
But why would you do that, like, in a relationship? That doesn't make sense. Like, what was the reason you would do that in a relationship? Like, let's say you're dating someone for 5 months, and why would you do that?
And you have a disagreement.
Okay.
And they're right. Okay, so you have a disagreement with somebody and they're right. They're absolutely right.
Okay.
So what do? You pull back. You pull back and you say, okay, maybe you're right. I don't give a fuck. This is my value. You're either going to play my game or I'm out. So then the other person is left making a judgment call. Do I want to be right, or do I want this person?
Yeah.
See the
shtick
here?
Yeah, I understand that. But I would say that it's not a good way to build a relationship, because that means that every time...
I'm talking about manipulation techniques. Of course it's not a good thing.
Okay, yeah, you're right. I guess I'm still, like, biased towards thinking, like, how would this actually work? Because the thing is, like, that would never, ever work in an actual relationship more than, like, once or twice. Because that would mean that, like, every time you would disagree with your, you know, partner, you'd be like, yep, I'm pulling out. Like, you know, unless you want to, you know, you want to concede stop saying that you're right and just be with me, then I'll just, like, pull out. And, like, if you put that on the table and threaten every time, that just seems very shitty, and I don't think that's gonna work for
it. It does seem shitty, but I can't really show you data, but my experience is that it has worked. I've seen it work. It's amazing how people call you back when you're not available.
Yeah, but, like, at the expense of the other person. Like, as you just said, like, that seems... You just said, like, do you want to be right, or do you want to, you know, keep being with that person? And that seems very... Yes. Yeah, so... I don't know. That seems like a very... Like, as I said, like, this might work once or twice, but I don't think you can do that 10 times in a row and still expect the other person to be like, yeah, I'm going to swallow my pride for the 10th time and you know, ignore that you're just, like, going to be the sound
absolutely.
Police.
I mean, it totally depends on the people. It depends on the relationship, I suppose, as well. It depends on how codependent is the other person, how much they're going to fall for it.
Yeah.
But it is a technique that some people use, and we're making this podcast, I suppose, for people to be aware of the technique. I'm hopefully they're not gonna be, you know, using it.
Yeah, I'm kind of scared this is gonna be a podcast of like what shitty techniques to use that work and you know, manipulate other people. Like that should not be our goal for this podcast.
I'm just saying, if the person is offering you your wish to be with them instead of their goodwill to discuss the problems that you have, then maybe they're not working in the interest of both parties. That's what this technique is supposed to make people aware of.
Say that again.
So if the other person using this technique is trying to put on the table their worth and how much you want them or how much you want their business, instead of presenting the arguments or, for example, trying to solve the current issues that both of you have, then perhaps that person using this technique is not working in the interest of you both.
That's totally what my point was. Yes, exactly. Yes. I totally agree with this. Yes, that was my feeling. I was like, yeah, this is not working if that... Yeah, exactly. This just says like, look, I care about myself more than I care about us, so like I don't give a shit. I'll just walk away if you.
Yes.
That's exactly how I understood the technique. I mean, yes. And now the more that you explain it, the more I realize that it's completely understandable. Like, because at the beginning I was like, whoa, that sounds very weird and very shitty, but I understand that now. Yeah.
Have you heard of the ultimatum game?
I mean, this is one way of one kind of ultimatum, right?
One kind of ultimatum. There's another one. I want to jump on it because it just appeared in my mind. Sure. Or if you want to talk about something else,
go ahead.
So this is actually an experiment. This is like something like the prisoner's dilemma. It's an experiment. It is awesome. I love it. And here's what happens. Here's how it's set up. And they actually did this in prisons, but it didn't work there. But it does work in places where while you're negotiating, you do not care about reputation. So let me just set it up for you. Okay, here's the thing. You have a bag of money, $1 million. And a person comes in the room with the bag and says, okay, there's two of you in the room. You can have the $1 million. No strings attached. All you need to do is decide how do you want to split it amongst yourselves.
Oh, yeah, I know this experiment.
All you need to do is reach an agreement. And when you reach the agreement, you just tell me and I'll give you the money. And you split it the way you want to split it. Okay, so option A is to be rational. And a rational party would say, okay, just, you know, it's two of us. Let's split it 50-50. Okay, that's the rational response. And option B, well, one of the other options, there are probably lots of variants on this, but I'm just going to say about one of the other options, is to be irrational and to put forth an ultimatum. And the person putting forth an ultimatum is going to say something along the lines of this. So here's what's going to happen. I am going to give you $100,000, 10% of the money, and not a dollar more. You can agree to take it, or we can both leave without a dollar in our pockets.
Yeah, but did you mention that? Because if you fail to reach an agreement, no one gets any money, right? That's also exactly. A key part of the experiment. Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
It can be a lose-lose game.
Yes.
So the irrational person is betting on the aspect that the other rational person does not want to end up in a lose-lose situation.
I wouldn't say that the rationality is at part here, because if you're rational, you would accept any amount of money, because, you know, $100,000 is better than $0. So actually a rational person would accept that. It's the problem of fairness and pride that gets in the way, right?
Exactly. That's what they're counting on. They're counting on your rationality. They're counting that you would say, okay, $100,000 is better than zero. and they're just playing with the minimal amount of money that you're willing to accept.
Yeah, exactly.
So they're going to make you extremely angry. They're going to make you feel extremely furious about their offer, but they want to give you a threshold that you are still willing to accept, that you're not just going to say fuck it all.
Yeah. The way I heard this experiment for the first time was that one person randomly gets assigned the money, kind of, but he has to agree with the other person. So, for example, most of the time, you know, the person who has the money will say, like, look, do you want 50%? Yes, and you're done, right? And then that's when the one who has kind of has the money would give this ultimatum, because that's how, because neither of you actually have any money. So, like, the other person could equally well say, like, no, I'm gonna give you 10% of the money, and you have to accept that. And that's why the version that I heard with the experiment says that one person has the money, in quotes, and is offering a percentage to the other person, which can be as low as 0% if mm-hmm. if they want to, right?
I just heard the variant where there are three people in the room. One is just the mediator, and the two parties are negotiating.
Okay, wait, what is the role of the mediator?
Yes, the role of the mediator is just offering the rules of the game. That's it.
Oh, Okay. Yeah. Yeah, people. Yeah, I've heard about this experiment. I don't remember the statistics, but like a lot of people wouldn't accept unfair deals, right?
There is the aspect of reputation involved, and this is what I said in the beginning before I explained the situation, and it's very important. Mm-hmm. If you have, that's why they couldn't do this. They couldn't do this in a prison environment, even with all the psychopaths running around, mm-hmm. because everybody knew everybody else, and there was this huge factor of reputation, because you're going to see that person tomorrow again and you might end up in trouble. So this thing can work more if you are introducing two parties that won't ever meet again. But if you're introducing two parties that are going to be having interactions on a continual basis, then you have a problem. They will just accept 50%.
Yeah, I see. So what would you offer? What do you think would be a reasonable place to start?
I am leaning towards the lose-lose situation. And I would kind of like to, depending on person to person, I would kind of pick off and test the person, their threshold of how much are they willing to give before leaving the table. And the whole time I would probably be playing on the card, okay, I'm ready to leave this table of negotiation at any given moment. That's how I would start.
Yeah, so I think yeah, I would do something like 30%. I think I would start there. It's neither fair nor completely unfair, and you can see like how acceptable that would be to the other person, and engage the reaction.
The interesting part is, as in order to get to a point of understanding, to a point of equilibrium of 50%, you need to start from a point of hostility, because otherwise you will get played. If you're starting from a point of reason and negotiating, you have a problem, because yes, the other person can be hostile.
That's true, but the if you start from the whole point of experiment is I think that if you start from a point of reason, it's going to end immediately. Like, no one's going to say no to 50-50. Like, if you say, like, all right, let's split it 50-50, I think
no one will even... No, I'm going to say I'm going to give you 10% if it's not a 50%, then you have a problem.
Yeah, but then you can counter as well. Be like, all right, if you want to play ridiculously bad, I'll also give you 10%, and then you'll negotiate back to 50-50.
But then we leave the table.
Yeah, then that happens.
That's your ultimatum. I'm leaving the table, and we get nothing. That's the ultimatum. And you're testing if the person is bluffing or if they're really that crazy and they're really going to leave the table.
Yeah, the way I heard this experiment interpreted was not in ultimatum power play, just like how innate our sense of fairness is. You know, like, this has been tested, I think, on kids as well, and like basically everyone has that same feeling of unfairness if they're not offered, you know, half. That was like the only interpretation I've heard, not this interesting power dynamic.
Yes, feeling bad when you're faced with an ultimatum is a given. With kids, with monkeys, with animals, with anything, you will feel bad. The question is, are you going to accept the subpar offer?
Yeah, yeah. Even monkeys feel unfairness. Yeah, that was. I know there's like an experiment with cucumbers, and I forgot something tasty, like a banana maybe, and like
bananas. Yes, exactly. That's the one.
Yeah, the monkey that gets cucumbers, like even the other monkey that eats bananas gets angry because it's not fair that he gets bananas and the other gets cucumbers or something like that, because you know cucumbers suck.
Cucumbers suck. It's
yeah.
Just sweet water.
Yeah.
Okay.
Interesting.
So this was interesting. Do you want to start a subject or should
yeah,
I move on to the
let's do like a media manipulation experiment. So first of all, when you said, you know, one-on-one manipulation, I had a feeling that it was going to be more like Dale Carnegie's, you know, How to Win Friends and Influence People, and not like this really psychopathic ultimatum games and power plays.
Oh, it gets better. We wait for it.
Yeah.
Okay, never mind.
Yeah, yeah. No, yeah, don't spoil it. We'll get there, I guess. With all the recent stories about, you know, Cambridge Analytica manipulating the, our democracy, I guess, or yeah, the people on Facebook. And I guess it's kind of a media manipulation where you're doing, you know, ads and maybe even fake news that you can classify it into media manipulation. And I think to start it off, it was Bernays. He was, a nephew of Freud, I think. So he was, I guess, influenced by the psychoanalysis, aspect of propaganda.
People, exactly.
Yeah, and he has a bunch of books like Propaganda, Public Relations, like The Engineering of Consent. So these are all books that his goal was to shift public opinion in presumably a democracy to whatever goal needs fulfilling. So he was unfortunately he didn't differentiate between you know goals that would be admirable and goals which would be very bad for society, if that just means that he did his you know his goal of manipulating people. So for example, he was a very influential employee of the cigarette companies, and he's being kind of demonized because of that, and I think rightly, because he basically was the one who manipulated, you know, a lot of women into smoking. Like what he did was he conflated the movement of feminism and, you know, fighting for your rights with like cigarettes. He made it so that, you know, if you're a strong, independent woman, you would be smoking cigarettes. So he kind of conflated the two movements, and it resulted in a lot of people starting to smoke. And unfortunately, you know, as we know, that was pretty bad for society and for all the people who died from lung cancer. He seemed very, very unfazed by the consequences of his actions. But I think we shouldn't demonize him that much, because if it weren't for him, someone else would be doing the same thing. And you know, if it weren't for him putting these things out in a book, it would be the Nazis who would use them and not, you know, share the knowledge from the propaganda that they did, which was very useful in Nazi Germany, you know, in World War II. They might have been influenced by him, you know, we don't know, because his books came out like in, you know, 1928, for example. So that like the Nazis may have been reading his books and being influenced by his tactics. But I guess we'll never know how influential he was. But in any case, he's very, very well known in the marketing field.
So tell me, how did he do it?
Well, one thing I mentioned was, right, the feminist, you know, he used like the torches of freedom. That was his motto for cigarettes, which, you know, when you hear it, it really sounds sounds so tantalizing.
It's the invention of framing, I would say.
Yeah, exactly. He would use some basic human desire, like, you know, freedom and or pride or accomplishment, and tie that to something nefarious that needed more support. So exactly, so to give an example, right? You have people standing on the street that use his tactics. Like the other day, I was approached by a person on the street who was doing probably like some interviews, you know, like someone that asks you a bunch of questions for a survey or something, right? Mm-hmm. And so they don't say like, you know, hey, do you have a minute to, I just need to like three questions to ask you three questions. So they're like, hey, do you have a minute for these questions? Do you have 5 minutes to save a human life? That was like the thing that they started.
Exactly.
Like,
exactly,
you know, because
right.
these questions will help in, you know, a cancer study, and that'll save a human life. So they ask you, like, you have 5 minutes to save a human life. And if you say no, that means that you won't even spare 5 minutes to save a human life. So Yeah,
that's the framing.
Yes, like in the other case, you're bad. You either waste 5 minutes, you know, answering those questions, which, of course, they might not be a waste if you think about it. But for you, at least, they will be because you're not going to get any tangible benefit from that. Or you're being framed as a, you know, cancer enthusiast.
Yes, they're playing the card of moral superiority. I want to save lives and you don't.
Yeah.
And you just have to tell them that you don't know me and I'm not going to play this game by your rules.
Yeah, just say no. I mean, yeah, if you're strong enough to like to you know internalize that anger and be like, no, I don't have 5 minutes to save a life and continue on with your day without feeling bad, then that would probably be the best option. But I think a lot of people would feel really bad if they just said no and then continued walking. I know that I would feel bad for like 5 minutes at least.
In Bernays' case, there was one more example, I think.
Sure.
He conflated, he framed, you know, the possession of a vehicle, of a car, instead of a method of transportation, he framed it as a status symbol.
Oh, okay.
And that's how it, so he would like prime people, like he would make advertisements with a person that is desirable by women, mm-hmm. and he would link that with driving a car. So this is, you know, still present, or at least it was a lot more present in the 2000s in the media, where you are looked upon as very desirable by women if you are driving a great sports car. So they're not selling the method of transportation; they're selling the status object.
Yeah, so I've seen ads like that. There's literally an ad with Sean Connery. I think he's, you know, James Bond, and you know he's like so popular with women, and he like gets out of the car or something. I don't remember what car ad that was for, but it was definitely for some car.
Exactly. So that's and actually they made studies on this. I think Gatzat talked about it, as their males are much more likely to consider buying a more expensive vehicle if they are primed with a with an image of a female on the vehicle first. It goes even unconscious, because they're betting on this evolutionary highway of mate selection that males are more drawn to. Women don't care about that. They found really almost no significant difference if you prime women with a big, hot, sexy male for them to buy the car. No, they just care about the car.
Really? Okay. Interesting.
Yes, different rules are drawn for women, and for different things are made for drawing women and men. For example, women are much more influenced by shaming instead of seeking status. So, for example, you have a lot of billboards and pictures of women selling fashion or cosmetics or whatever have you, that are the absolute most gorgeous girls that you can find. And the thing is that when you think about it, that message is meant for women. It's not meant for men. You know, men don't buy women's clothes on average. The reason for that is they want to shame the women for not being good enough. And yeah. This works immensely.
Yeah, that sounds horrible, but I guess it works.
it does work, yes. That's why they have the most beautiful women. There was this one joke. The women in those pictures don't look like the women in those pictures. Meaning they're photoshopped to hell.
Oh, yeah. You know, sure.
Nobody can have a body like that. Nobody can look 24 hours, you know, just stunningly like that. You know, everybody is like normal once in a while.
Yeah, that's true.
Okay, so. Yeah.
Do you have another one-on-one manipulation technique?
Okay, I have another one. It's just this plain old simple isolation.
Okay.
And isolation is effective, and I'm just going to explain what I mean by isolation, because it has a lot of meanings. And so in this context, I mean, when you are in a group, let's say you have six people,
mm-hmm.
and within those six people, you need to reach some kind of agreement. some decision needs to be made. So one way to do it is to sit down with everybody, just put the facts on the table, put the situation on the table, and have a discussion and ask what you need to do. The other thing is just to talk to everybody separately. And when you're talking to everybody,
separately, but in private.
You have in private, exactly. Okay. So instead of sitting in a meeting, I'm going to invite you separately on coffee or to dinner. And we're just going to discuss the opportunities between ourselves. And I'm going to do that with the next guy, and I'm going to do that with the next guy, and I'm going to do that with the next guy. And all the while, I am giving each and every one of you a different story. And I'm catering to your own personal desires. So I will never put myself in an uncontrolled environment where everybody can have a productive discussion. I'm going to ask you for consent when we're having coffee. And then I'm just going to say, okay, my friend has already consented on this. What do you think about it? And then I'm going to do that with the next person. And I'm going to say, okay, my two other friends are in agreement with this. What do you think about it? And I am building up legitimacy and I'm building up consent that way. So that's the isolation part.
Yeah, I understand this. I guess there's not much to say here except that it works.
It's very important to be aware when this is happening because here's the thing. When you sit down with a person and they're talking to you, catering to your own interests instead of the interest of the organization, the group, or whatever, you need to know that they are probably doing with the same. They're probably doing the same thing with the other people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So even if you can get some short-term benefit from it, it might be wise to consider that the same thing can happen to you. And sometimes in the near future, when you have a grievance or a disagreement, this technique will be used against you. Hmm. So you need to be open that you want to discuss the things that should be discussed in the meeting with the people that should be in the meeting, not separately on coffee or on a dinner or wherever.
Yeah, so I guess the only way to counter this is for everyone to be aware of this. And when the person tries to do that one-on-one, you should be like, no, we'll do this in a meeting with everyone else.
Exactly. Because
there's no way to, no other way to.
Even if in the meeting you don't get your way 100%, it's good to sacrifice a little bit of what you wanted to get in the situation just so that the group has the full legitimacy to make the decision. For example, I had a situation where I had a partner where he would communicate with everybody individually. Every time we had a discussion, he would, for example, because we're on long distance, we would discuss it maybe via messages or via phone, person per person. Hmm. We had a Facebook group, so to speak. But suddenly, magically, that Facebook group became unimportant. You know, he decided that, okay, this isn't effective, so I'm just going to talk to everybody individually. If we were to keep talking on that Facebook group, if I were to, like, ask a question in front of everybody and get the appropriate responses, the decisions made would be much different.
Yeah,
because everybody is present in the conversation. While we're communicating with messages or by phone or by one-on-one meetings, we are making decisions that are mostly in our separate interests. But in the long runs, in the long term, when that person gets a lot more authority, you're going to have a big problem.
Yeah.
Yeah, we went through another one.
Interesting. I had another example for the one that we mentioned for the do you have 5 minutes to save a life? You said it was moral superiority, but now that I think about it, I think it's more of like a loaded question because technically, for example, when you when you go to a website, sometimes they'll say like sign up for our newsletter and they'll say like do you like free information that would be useful for you, then, you know, put your email. So, like, if you say no, you're being an idiot, right? You're like, no, I don't want free useful information, so I'm not gonna, you know, put my email. So, like, they're kind of loading, you're framing the question in that way. So it's not like, it doesn't have to be like moral superiority. It can just be the way that they say it so that you feel bad for saying no to that, right?
Exactly. That's just saying that you're a dupe because you don't want something free, which is immediately a red flag that you should start thinking about when it's free. The moral superiority part comes when they start showing you pictures of hungry babies. And that's when they're just communicating to you, look, I'm a good person because I want to help those people. And you're not. Obviously, you're not because you don't want to help those people. That's when moral superiority comes into play.
Yeah, but it's more like you don't want to help them right now in this exact way. That's the actual truth, you know, in the situation. It's not like you don't want to help the people, right? It's like you just don't want to do it the way they want to help those people and in this exact moment that they want to do it. So, for example, you know, the easy thing to do is like people, you know, see a picture, as you said, like, and they would be very... very saddened by the, you know, hunger that still pervades the world and be like, yes, I'm gonna, you know, give money to you right now because then I'll feel better. Or like, you know, you go down the street and you see an unfortunate person and then you give them some money. But like, that's not the way to go if you really wanna, you know, help. Like the way to go is something that's not gonna make you feel good, but it's actually gonna help more. For example, you lobbying, you know, in your government for like increased, I don't know, welfare payments to people, right? Like that's gonna save a lot more lives than you giving a bunch of money, you know, every now and then to someone in the street, right? Like that's gonna help a lot more. Or if you think about saving human lives in Africa, for example, the irrational thing would be like to see a picture and be like, yes, I'm gonna send money to this exact person, you know, every year. Like that's sure, that's gonna help one person. But Bill Gates actually thought about this thing and he said, you know, the best way to do it is like with $2 you can buy a mosquito net and prevent malaria. And it turns out that the most cost effective thing to reduce suffering in Africa is to like prevent malaria because that affects 100 million people per year there. So like you have to like put aside your emotional, you know, side and just be completely rational and see that the best way to use your money would be this or that way and not the way that's being advocated by some groups on the street, right?
Exactly. So you choose the way that you're going to go forward with this, and you don't let people say that I know the right way to do it, because they chances are that they're going to use that money for something else as well.
That's true.
One more argument here to be made, just as a follow up here, is that if you want to help the distant person, it's not even necessary to give $1. So I would argue that it is much better to provide some value to some professional value in your life. For example, if you're a programmer and you are developing something that is helping your society, and this is shown by your programs or services being valued on the market, then you are helping your society kind of evolve, stabilize, and get economically stronger, which is going to pour in money in a cost-effective way where they can then be later used for some specialized program. Now, this can be by the government, or if you have a surplus later in your life, then you can decide to invest them in a charity or whatever have you. But for somebody that's like 20 or 30 years old and they're working a blue-collar work, or maybe they're students, with your little contribution, you can't really change the world too much. It's much better to develop personally, to have a better value on the market, to start producing some value. And then if you get a surplus, maybe then you can think about helping someone else.
Exactly. This is well known. Exactly what you described. You have you can, you need to, at the early beginning of your career, if you, you need to establish your human capital, and then you can capitalize on that to gain, you know, once you have a lot of money, then you can donate whatever you want. So like, yeah, you have to use your advantages. For example, if you're, imagine that you, you're quite rich, but you feel like that you want to help people. You can either quit your job and go to a nonprofit and do some, you know, small, like menial work, or you can actually continue staying as a CEO on Wall Street. And even though you will feel bad, you can still donate a lot of money because you'll just be very rich. So you can just donate a lot of money to those organizations. You can maybe like buy a job opening for 5 people in that nonprofit. Whereas like if you quit your job, you would just be one person there and they would have to pay you. Whereas you would be able to support 5, you know, new job openings for that nonprofit. So like it all depends on what you have and where in career you are. I think we could do a whole episode on effective altruism. That's like a whole field of people thinking out how best to influence the world in a better way with the limited amount of money that they have. Yeah,
exactly. And there, I've just heard some examples of rich people. They don't really donate too much to some charities, but they usually tend to donate a lot into science. For example, for things that concern them, heart disease or Alzheimer's, because they know that 20 years ahead, they might get it too. So they pour money into it because they know that they're going to face that problem sooner or later, which is also a good way to help society. I mean, why not? Health research is important.
That's a good and a bad way to help society, because if you think about it, that's only going to fix the problems that rich people care about, right? That's why we have the neglected tropical diseases. We have a vaccine for a lot of Western stuff, right? But we don't have a vaccine for trichosomiasis, right? Because that worm does not occur in you know, well-developed North hemisphere, you know, countries, right? This only develops, like it only occurs in tropical areas, right? And because the rich people are not there, like they just don't care about it. There's no funding for that, even though thousands of people die by these neglected tropical diseases, right? So if you think about it, it's actually really, like, if you're not aware of the bias, it's not, you know, it's, so for example, right, to fix heart disease, you would need billions and billions more dollars, right? But maybe to fix these things, you don't need that much money, but no one cares enough to give you that money. And so if you want to be like an effective altruist, you should say like, wait, where is my money going to have the most impact, and focus on that.
Yes, exactly. There is a way to cater to these people of great financial means, but you just need to frame it differently. So if you were a nonprofit, you wouldn't tell them, for example, please save these people in Africa that are suffering because of this disease doesn't have a vaccine. You would frame it in a way, please save these people in Africa. It's very cheap. And if you don't, chances are there's going to be instability in the region and some of them might end up in your backyard.
Sure. But I would even question, like, do you think, like, why wouldn't people care that much? I mean, this might sound really dumb, but like, why doesn't every person actually care if you tell them, like, look, these people are going to die and you can put just a small amount of money and help these? Like, why do you think that's not going to be enough? Like, should we? I mean, I'm kind of saying, are people good natured or not?
There are two reasons. The first reason, and I'm not sure that this is the strongest, is because they have distrust of nonprofits, of charities, of institutions, even in the government. That's the first reason. The second reason is everybody has their own problems. And most of the people are consumed by their problems 24 hours. They're just going to be like, I do not have time for this. And sometimes they're even right. They are consumed by their jobs. They're consumed by problems in their family. They just cannot think about the people in Africa. And I think that's legitimate. I mean, you have your own problems. Now, we should find ways to help the people in our society to be relieved of their problems and maybe be a little more relaxed. But until everybody is into their own world, locked in a box, then we're going to have a limited scope of influence areas that we can, you know, provide for.
Yeah. Oh, I guess we kind of veered off of the manipulation subject with the with this. Did you have any other?
Should I pick one more?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, I have like 10 more.
Oh, nice.
Okay, so this one is an ideological defense. It's something between manipulating the masses and manipulating you personally. I would call it appeal to the greater good.
Mm-hmm.
So the moral superiority argument kind of ties into this as well. So for example, I am doing something.
Mm-hmm.
It's being done wrong. And this other person is going to express their grievances because I'm doing it wrong. And they're going to express arguments why it shouldn't be done that way. Maybe I'm engaged in corruption. And instead of addressing the arguments, I'm going to say, I'm going to give the classical ideological defense, and I'm going to say, well, I'm doing it for the insert greater good here. So I'm doing it on behalf of the workers. I'm doing it on behalf of religion. I'm doing it on behalf of the rainforest. I'm doing it on behalf of my community, whether it's, I don't know, Jewish, French community or whatever.
Sure.
So I'm going to appeal to the greater good, and immediately I'm going to charge that person that has the arguments of attacking the greater good instead of attacking me and my conduct. So I'm going to say something like, well, you don't want my French citizens to have a better life in some aspect. You're attacking them, or you're attacking the workers by your inactivity and your not willingness to agree with me. So mm-hmm. that's the appeal to the greater good. It used to be back like 20 years ago, 10 years ago, it used to be used a lot in religion, but now it just kind of spread out, and it's used in different areas.
Do you have an example from religion?
Well, from religion is you're attacking our way of life and you're attacking God.
I guess.
Back when it was taboo to discuss this, it would be a legitimate form of you're attacking the greater good. So if the priest is doing some nefarious thing and you counter him and you expose it, he's going to say that, well, if you expose this, you are doing a disservice to the church. You are doing a disservice to your community. You are attacking your community. They're going to frame you as the bad actor in this scenario because they're pure. You know, they're working for the greater good. They're working for the rainforest. They're working for an NGO. They are working for, in the interest of the workers, even though they haven't been elected by the workers in some factory or company or whatever. But they present themselves as if they are working in some other person's interest. I value people a lot more when they say, I don't like this. Okay, so stop doing it because I don't like it. And I'm going to give you my selfish arguments as to why I think that your argument shouldn't hold. But if I put myself as a defender of the faith or as a defender of the greater good, then chances are that I'm probably trying to weasel my way out of this situation.
Yeah, makes sense. Interesting.
One more group of people are doing this, and you've heard of them. PETA.
Sure, yeah. People for the Eating of Tasty Animals.
Exactly that. Yeah. They're, you know, the sushi meat eaters and all carnivore alliance.
So sushi
when you attack,
so what was that?
Just kidding. Just kidding. So when you attack their tactics, and when you attack the instances where they go too far, they're going to frame it as you attacking the greater good, which in this instance is the life of animals.
Yeah.
Yes. That's true. But you're not focusing on, you know, the life of animals is a whole different subject. You're attacking their arguments. You're attacking the way they conduct, they are, the way they are conducting themselves. And that should be on the table. And
yeah, PETA,
you need to make
worst.
Sure to get that back on the table.
Yeah. It's a good example. Yeah, that's a good example because PETA are really the worst. They're completely unscientific and they don't care. They just want to promote their agenda and they really don't care about the science. So they would like cherry pick anything that they would hear about if that might further their... Sometimes they would even like straight up lie. You know, there's a lot of those ads that turns out they're like complete bullshit and they just use those ads. They don't care. They just want, you know, I think now it's like a perpetuating circle of they need more money, more funding because they're a non-profit, right? So like to do that, they become more and more radicalized because, you know, they're going to get more money if they fight more, even though they are not fighting well or they're fighting kind of dirty with like disinformation, etc. But yeah, they're the worst example of animal activism. There's probably no one worse. I think Greenpeace is not as bad as PETA in this regard.
I think they were pretty much attacking GMOs, Greenpeace, for quite a while.
Yeah, they're pretty bad. I'm saying like PETA is even worse than that. Yeah,
okay.
They're like, you know, I know like the leader was I forgot her name, but she did. I think she had diabetes, so she was using insulin, but she didn't.
Okay.
You know, she was against animal suffering for like animal testing, right? Because that's hurting animals. But she was using insulin, which was artificially created, but tested on, you know, actually animals. Like it was, yeah. Like that's how science was done. You need the animals to be tested before you can use it on humans. So like, how can you be against that if you're using the products, right? Yeah.
Can I tie one more example in this?
Yeah,
just
for sure.
Because we talked about PETA. Mm-hmm. I'm going to talk about another principle. This is something we just engaged in. And that's why I want to talk about it.
Ooh, okay.
It's called low-hanging fruit. So the examples that I quoted with religion or with PETA are the worst examples out there. So this is me picking on low-hanging fruit. They're very easy to debunk. They're very easy to vilify. So because I'm engaging... as we were just engaging now in talking about PETA or maybe the scandals with the Catholic Church or the priest or whatever have you. These are already established examples. The community knows about them and they prevent people from seeing the nuances in a discussion. So, for example, with our example of PETA and the church, we would give, some arguments as to why this is a problem. But if I were to want to manipulate this conversation, when I'm going to pick off that low-hanging fruit, I'm going to say that all religion is a problem and that there is nothing absolutely positive to be derived from it, which is a conversation in and of itself. Or I would say that all animal rights activists are problematic because of PETA, because of this one low-hanging fruit example. So that's another instance of a manipulation technique. I pick
sure.
the worst of the worst,
sure.
and then I generalize on everybody that is even loosely associated with a group.
But we didn't do that, right? We didn't say that animal rights are bad because PETA is doing a really shitty job, right? We didn't say that.
Exactly. And if we were to say it, that would be picking on low-hanging fruit.
Yes. Yes. If we were to do that, that would definitely be... that would just be a bad generalization, honestly. Like, that's... Or, like, kind of, you know, poisoning the well. Or I guess that's kind of a fallacy where you know, since... since PETA would be poisoning, you know, the animal rights movement, whereas they shouldn't be. They should just be isolated for their bad deeds and not, you know, not be able to tarnish the whole movement. I agree.
Okay. Hey, just one question. Is there some noise in my background?
No, I think you're good.
Okay, great. Let's continue.
Yeah. What else do you have in one-on-one manipulation?
I have another one. I have human shields.
Actually, since we're talking about the earlier ones, there was one I wanted to mention. Have you heard of gaslighting?
Okay, tell me about gaslighting.
So I remember this even in the beginning when you said like something that has been used by psychopaths for one-on-one manipulation. It's gaslighting is, I think, something that psychopaths use, that basically you try to, so this is, I think, done more in relationships where you try to make the other person question their own sanity. Well, I mean, their own memory, and then further as you go down the line, their own sanity. It's really, it's like you denying stuff and using misdirection or even lying, honestly, just to be able to convince the other person that, no, you're right. Like, it's like, I'm the person who's right and the other person is just wrong and misremembered, or, you know, just does not, like, should not trust their own judgment. And, I think, like, the best way to do this is, I mean, the worst way to do this, because this is a bad thing, is like, you know, you would, for example, I don't know, let's say that someone misplaced their keys, right? And then you would, mm-hmm. you would, and let's say that you took the keys, right? That you want to, you know, gaslight this person. So they'd be like, oh no, where are my keys? And you would say like, I don't know, did you look everywhere? And they'd be like, yeah, I looked everywhere. And you could say like, oh, did you look on the table? And then they'd be like, yes, I looked on the table. And then you would put it on the table and be like, well, are you sure you looked on the table? And then they're like, wait a minute, I thought I looked on the table. So like you would pretend, you know, you would pretend that the keys were there just to make them question their own, you know, sanity, and then basically be lying and deceitful in that way. I think this is rare, because I mean, you have to be a really, really hardcore psychopath to be doing something like this. And the only good reason to do this is to either, you know, make the person very dependent on you. I think that's one of the reasons that people give, like, mm-hmm. to make, you know, the other person just trust you completely, right? Because you can very easily misuse that trust. And I'm not sure, were you familiar with this manipulation technique?
I've heard of the term, and I've heard of it being used in a political context, but I cannot remember the way it functions. I cannot remember an example. Yes,
I'm not sure.
I've heard the term being thrown around a lot, but I cannot remember a concrete, a specific example about it. So if you have anything off the top of your head more, maybe you can clarify a little bit.
Wait. I think I know what you mean by political. I actually did read something similar, that basically there was a rivalry between Clinton and Gingrich. Gingrich was a Republican opposition leader during Bill Clinton's presidentship. I mean, his presidential term. Yes. And basically they said it was gaslighting, the way that Clinton was, you know, Clinton would put Gingrich through like these small shitty things, and then, you know, he would get angry to just provoke him, and then you'd be like, oh, look, he's acting so hysterical, right? But actually, they're the one doing it.
Right.
You know,
I got it now.
Yeah, kind of like questioning their own, you know, they're questioning their own, like, this is not the reaction you're supposed to be, you know, be having to this, and saying like, no, like, trust me, like, I'll tell you how you're supposed to react, or like, you shouldn't be doing this. Does that make sense?
Yes, and now when you said they're going to provoke him into being a bit more hysterical, and then they're going to point the finger at him and say, look at him, what a bad person he is, I got it at that point.
Yeah, it's hard to define. I mean, to be honest, I don't really understand that either. It's kind of a murky term, and I think it's very easy to misuse that, so maybe we're defining it incorrectly, but in any case, that's what I've heard about it. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was one.
I have a personal one in relation to this whole greater good mm-hmm, phenomenon. Sure. So this is just between people. The human shield kind of thing. It's putting yourself in front of a victim.
Okay.
For example, you would say, don't fire me, because the whole department is going to suffer. Okay, so you're just gonna put your whole department as a human shield, and you're gonna say that if I leave, if I lose, then your whole department is going to function suboptimally, and therefore you should pardon my conduct and my mistakes. So that's like putting yourself in front of a human shield. Or the classic example in, for example, the political sphere is with terrorism. where terrorists are going to intentionally set themselves up. They're going to set up a base in a school or in a hospital.
And
they're going to say, okay, don't bomb us because you're going to kill a lot of kids. You know, and they're going to use this as political leverage. Now, depending on the player on the other side, they're going to maybe work out a deal, or they're just going to straight up bomb them. And it's a very difficult choice to make when you're faced with the human shield, for example.
Interesting. Yeah, so, it sounds so obvious when we speak about these things this way, but I think that, you know, in the situation when this happens, you have to think about all the ways that this could be, you know, some kind of manipulation. I think it's really hard to do in real life.
I'm going to give you a personal life example. Sure. Okay, so you have a meeting where you are discussing some problem. Mm-hmm. And you have grievances on the meeting, and you express these grievances. And you are being shut down with the excuse that you've hurt everybody else's feelings. For example, the case I was in was the person that I was expressing a grievance towards was that, well, my wife has worked on this project for hours.
Your wife or his wife?
His wife. Okay. Has worked on this project for hours and hours, and now you're just going to let it all go because you don't agree. So the person is asking you to pardon their conduct on the behalf of a victim, on the behalf of a human shield.
Wow, that's a really bad argument. Especially like just the sunk cost fallacy in that is so stupid. Like even if no one is being hurt, to give a reason that you should go ahead with this or that just because there's, you know, time and resources have been spent is a really
it's very easy to be painted as the bad actor in this situation.
That's true.
Because all of the people are just looking at the situation, and they're looking at the victim. They're not looking at the arguments. They're looking at the emotional side of the thing.
So how would you counter this and these in general? Do you just point out that this is the tactic that's being used against you right now? What do you think?
So there's a problem with this, because if this tactic is effective, then you are immediately ousted as the bad actor, and nobody in your group wants to communicate with you anymore. So you have been pointed out as the bad actor, and communication has stopped. So you cannot defend your arguments anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a very fast tactic that you need to do. Just say that the other person is a bad person, give it a victim, and then just cut ties. When you cut ties, the group gets smaller, conformity in the group gets bigger, and the person has no way to express their grievances, even if they're founded. Yay, went through another one.
Yeah, you said you had 10 more.
Yeah, okay, let's go to the next one. I want to talk about theoretical versus functional outcomes.
Okay. Is this in terms of manipulation?
Yes. So I'm just gonna tell you what I mean by this. This isn't like a formal term about it. So here's a theoretical outcome. You and me have a problem, and we are discussing this problem in a group, and I am the bad actor in this scenario. And I'm also this group's leadership. And here's what I say. I say, okay, if everybody agrees with you, then I will put forth my resignation. That's a theoretical outcome. If everybody agrees with you, I will put forth my resignation. What happens is that I'm claiming to be a person that can be relied upon. But that will not happen in the functional world. That will not be a functional outcome. So because I said that I will put up my resignation, the whole group is going to assume that I have the group's best interest at heart. Mm-hmm. While in fact, if they decide that the other person was right and that I'm going to, in fact, need to cede the point, I will not put up my resignation. I will functionally never do that. Instead, I will probably leave or shut down the company and never call again. So I'm pretending that there is a theoretical option for me to be the to be just, but that is functionally never going to happen.
I see, yeah. But it's kind of a bluff, right? You're basically having like a high risk bluff, you know. You're basically, this bluff works because you're strengthening your position because mm-hmm. it's probably not going to happen, and yeah, yes. And even if it did, you're saying that you're not going to do it anyway, so it's yeah. Yeah, makes sense. It's interesting. So do these have names, or you said this one is not official?
I just said it the way I see it. It's yeah, not really a name. I had to call it something.
Yeah. I guess you're talking about really hardcore manipulation with these things, because when we said this at the beginning, I thought it was going to be more like, you know, Benjamin Franklin's trick, you know, in quotes, by asking someone that doesn't like you that much for something small, like a small favor. So not you doing a small favor for them, but you asking them to do you a small favor. And when they do that, well, it should be really small that they wouldn't be able to say
no. That's the foot in the door, right?
No. Different. Let's get to that as well. But this is different, because what's going to happen is you'll ask for something really banal, like something small that doesn't really, not that you wouldn't, that they wouldn't be able to say no. And then when they do that, they will kind of rationalize it to themselves that, yeah, you know, I guess it is, that person is not that bad, since I gave them the book that they asked to borrow, like, you know, obviously I must like them. Of course, you're not, you know, talking to yourself, you're not saying this, mm-hmm. but subconsciously it's probably something that happens to you.
You're playing along.
Yeah. You're like, I guess they're not that bad if I'm doing this for them. So like, it's kind of the foot in the door is something different, right? That would be something that you would ask for something small and then ask for something bigger and bigger and bigger, right? Mm-hmm. That would be the metaphorical foot in the door.
Okay, I have an example for the one you just quoted. Not the foot in the door. How did you call it?
I don't know. The Benjamin Franklin effect. I think he's famous for that.
The Benjamin Franklin effect.
It was in his autobiography.
Let's roll with that.
Yeah.
So I have a really bad example for that one.
Mm-hmm.
As in dark. That can be used as well as in sexual harassment.
Oh, okay.
So check this out. So somebody wants to have his way with somebody in the office.
Okay.
Or some other girl or whatever have you. And
sorry, did you just assume the harasser's gender? So it's a guy harassing a girl? Come on. This is just a stereotype. I'm kidding. Continue.
I'm just gonna roll with the averages. So what would happen is that they know that you're part of their inner circle, and they need you to be silent about it,
okay.
If not complacent. So they are going to share some trivia about the girl in front of you as in a way to claim her. And this kind of happens with guys a lot when they're in groups. It's like, oh, look at that girl. Oh, she's so, you know, cute or hot or whatever have you. And what this person will do is, for example, show you a picture of her. And he would like, you know, give you the phone, and he'll be like, look at her. She's an artist. You know, and you're looking at the picture, and he'll be like, oh, yeah, man, she's an artist. She's also beautiful. You know, that's very obvious.
Yeah.
And because you kind of had this polite conversation, you're a little bit on board with it. I'm tempted to say unconsciously, but it's not even that.
I'm not sure. This is a really interesting example.
This is probability. If he were to do something with the girl after that, you would have a lesser probability of expressing disgust.
I see what you mean.
Whereas if he were to just go with a girl and do something that you would find a bit repulsive morally, and this happened out of the blue, you would immediately express disgust. But because he has had that conversation with you, because he has familiarized you with the subject, the probability of you expressing some kind of concern or disgust is a bit lower. And I'm not talking about underage sexual manipulation. I'm just talking about hitting on people you shouldn't be hitting on. And this is very relatively in moral terms.
But wouldn't the main thing gained from this conversation just be the fact that the other person can rationalize the harassment by saying like, oh, well, they like, you know, insert other person artist's name. So that's why they did that. So like, that would be the only reason I would think someone would be okay with it. But I don't agree. Like, I totally understand what you're saying, but I'm not sure how effective that would be. So you say, you know, there's going to be a lower probability, but I'm not sure if there really is going to be a lower probability. I would say that the only way to achieve a lower probability would be for that person to say something. I have a good example, I think. So I would say that, let me give a really bad example. Let's say that person looks at the girl and let's say that he would say something like, oh man, look at the, you know, the ass on that girl, right? And
exactly.
Then in this case, I would say that it would be a lower probability, because now if you don't say something bad to this person, like, hey, what are you talking about? You can't say that, you know, don't be such a dick. Then you would have a lower probability of saying something about the harassment. So in this case, I would say definitely. Yeah.
Exactly. So you just took it a step further in the right direction. So yeah. He's going to just point out the ass. Okay, just look at that ass. Beautiful ass. And he would be like, okay, what do you think about it? You know, and you'll be like, well, it's really hot. I mean, it's a fantasy. What can I say? And because you have agreed with him that this is the kind of person that you would like to be with, they're going to take that as a permission for them to do something.
Yes, I agree, but only in that case. If you just say like, oh, you know, that girl is really beautiful or something, like if you're not being a bad actor in any capacity, then I don't think that this will change the probability. Only if you do something bad, but not really that bad to be called out immediately, and then do something worse, then I think that it'll help. Only in that case.
Okay.
Yeah. That's interesting. Yeah, it's a good way of analyzing. Like the things that you mentioned, I think have occurred to both of us probably a lot in our lives. But if you never, you know, think about it, you're not aware of it.
The problem is that you get aware of these things sometimes when it's kind of late.
That's true.
And then you'll be like, why didn't I think of this earlier? You know, why didn't I see it that way? But sometimes it just passed. And when something like that happens, let's just go on to the next one. When a bad actor gets away with something, or when a bad actor fails to deliver on a promise, what usually happens is what we call victim blaming. You've heard of this, I suppose.
Yes, of course.
Yes, I'm not going to go, oh my God, I'm not going full feminist here, but the concept does hold out some truth in it.
No, it's really an interesting concept. And it's I think the easiest way to do it is to mention a feminist, you know, trope for that. Do you know, like are you aware of the skirt thing with rape?
Rape?
Yeah.
Yes, I'm aware, aware of it.
I think that's the worst type of victim blaming ever. Like, you know, people literally sometimes ask like, oh, but what was she wearing when she got raped? As if that excuses someone raping.
It absolutely does not excuse the deed, but, and there is a but here, I am unashamedly saying it, there is a conversation to be had about responsibility. You, as a girl, are responsible for your own safety.
Sure.
And you should know, and you should be able to predict not to put yourself in an environment where you can be harmed. The police, the authorities, the court system is there to pick up the pieces and solve the problem after it has begun. You really need to know what are the factors that are going to influence a possible bad situation. So with women, for example, this problem has been discussed as well as from an evolutionary point of view, as that it has been observed that they are dressing more provocatively, even though they tend to do it unconsciously, when they're ovulating.
Okay, but how does this excuse rape?
I just said in the first instance that it does not in any case excuse rape. I'm talking about responsibility, that you should know not to put yourself in a bad situation. I am not excusing the perpetrator, and I need to delineate this.
So you're saying that women should dress less scantily if they're going out because someone might rape them? That's what I'm getting so far.
I'm just trying to observe that there are factors in a very complex society that lead to a bad event happening, and that we should be aware of those factors.
Yes. Okay, so I see what you mean. I see what you mean.
Yes. Provocative.
I agree. So let's put it in matters.
I prefer if they don't walk down a dark alley when they're doing it.
Yes, I agree. So yes. So there's two. Yes. So let me give an example. I think I understand your argument. So let's say that this is true, because I think this is true. If you don't walk alone in a dark alley, the probability of getting raped is smaller. That we agree on. Yes. Right. Yes. If you dress less scantily, less provocatively, then the probability of getting raped is smaller. We agree on that.
Now, can we stop here? Just 1 second. That does not mean that the woman is being immoral in any way.
Oh, no, no, no.
You
no,
should
no.
be able to dress any way you want. You just should know the foundations and the complexities in the world that we live in.
Yes.
You need to be aware of them. That's all I'm saying.
Yeah, the only difference between the two is that I can't really explain the difference, but I would say that it's totally okay to say to that person, wait, don't walk down a dark alley, during the weekend because you might get raped. Yes, but to say that don't dress like that because that'll increase the probability, I find that very... I don't know. I find these two things very different, but I can't really articulate why one thing is totally okay to. I think it's because it infringes on the freedom of the other person, and the other does not.
Here's the thing. When I was talking about this earlier, I did not say that you shouldn't dress that way. What I said that women tend to dress that way, even if that behavior is unconscious during ovulation.
Okay.
And
sure.
This has been an observed effect. All I'm saying is that we should be aware of it. And if the girl is aware of it, she can. It's responsibility and guilt are two different things. The perpetrator is guilty. The women in this example should also be responsible for her own safety. And it's a very hard difference to, it's very nuanced. It's a very hard difference to delineate.
I agree, but I think that some things add responsibility, like not walking down a dark alley. But other things, I wouldn't say that they should be held responsible, like the way they dress. Of course, this has limits. Like I don't want to say like if you walk down, but so yes, actually let's put it into extremes, right? Let's say that they walk naked down the street, right? But down like a normal street, right? You can't say that this excuses. Of course, this is horrible. Like, why would they walk down naked? But there's no excuse for that.
If they walk down naked,
yes,
are more people going to look at them?
Yes, look, sure, will that excuse in any way?
It's never excused. I never excused it in any instance. Responsibility, the term, I need to define it. It means able to respond. It means being aware of your situation and being able to act accordingly. It does not mean that you're guilty for the act. The guilty party is the one that committed the rape, and they should get full penalty for it. Responsibility means that you are able to respond, that you know your situation, and you can make certain predictions based upon it. I did a little bit of changing of definitions here in between the way you see it, I suppose.
No. I mean, we kind of agree, except that I don't think that it's their responsibility to dress the way that would be least amenable to rape. Like, I don't think that's a burden that we should impose upon women. That's my point. Like, just I don't think that should add any more response. Like, I think they're responsible enough as it is, because trust me that no woman is going to walk down the dark alley. Like, they know that for sure. But like, to basically shift the conversation even more towards women and be like, no, but not now, let's figure out a way for you to dress, you know, less provocatively so that, that these rapes occur less. Like, that seems very disingenuous, because, you know, the real problem
is an observed effect. Most of the, I mean, I don't have the numbers in front of me, but there is a higher instance of rape for women when they're ovulating, when they're not wearing underwear, when they're wearing skirts.
Yes.
So these are observable facts for which we should have an honest discussion about. Now,
I agree.
There is a trade-off here. I suppose, I mean, I don't know the right answer. You can either say, okay, be more responsible in your life. Or maybe you can say, try to maybe have some friends along or call a cab or whatever have you. And these are small interventions that can make a lot of difference. And I see no reason why women shouldn't be aware of this problem.
I agree. Yes, it's useful to, it's always useful to have the information. That for sure. Like, whatever the data is, like whatever the science says, we should always know this. I disagree with the policy prescription. You know, like what are we gonna do about it? Like that's like, where are we gonna put our resources to, like, women to, you know, educate them more and be like, yes, but don't wear this or that, or just like, or towards the people who are doing the act and say like, no, like,
exactly. So this is where we disagree on. I'm going to say that concerning the world that we live in, I'm going to go for the option that it will be more effective in preventing assaults if the women were more aware of their surroundings.
I agree.
It is less effective to take the other option and yes, to shame men, or to try to, I don't know, re-educate or whatever.
I completely agree with this. Yes. The only reason I'm against the more effective policy is because there is another liberty, another right, the right to freedom that's being impinged upon when you're doing your course of action. That's the only reason I don't like that, because
I'm not mandating anything. I'm not saying that anything should go into law. I'm just saying
not law. I'm just saying about everyday personal freedom. You know, like the because you're not, no, of course you're not forcing them. Yes,
I'm not gonna slut shame anybody if they try to dress provocatively. This is not about that. And I'm not going to go up to a stranger and girl and tell her that you're, you know, dressed indecently or what have you. No,
that would be pretty funny. to talk, not to rape or anything. I think we both articulated our opinions clearly on this. I think there's not much to say other than what we just did. I was gonna say something, but I forgot, so we can
concerning rape, one more thing. There was this Michael Shermer had an event with this scientist. I have no idea what kind of exact field he's in. He was studying honor killings. He was studying rapes. And okay, his basic advice to women was just be racist. In a nutshell, that was it. He outright said it. If you see a person of the wrong color or the wrong ethnic group walking...
It's very...
He was very direct.
But he said wrong. Like, are you saying that if you're another color, you're wrong?
He said the wrong ethnic group or the wrong color walking in towards you in a dark alley, move to the other side. Do not make your inner guilt put you in a situation where you can be harmed.
Yes, I totally agree with this. I totally agree with this. Except that the wording that he's using is really bad. Like, I think it would be much better to say
It's not bad in an empirical sense, though.
No, but no, of course. But I think you could have the same effect that he's advocating without using the words he's using, like, wrong. That's my point. Like, it's
just really old school. He didn't care about words at all. Like,
yeah, but the problem is, like, it turns out that he's actually a big creep. Like, this is kind of recent.
He's actually, he was this kind of a person trying to help women, like, most of his life. He was studying honor killings a lot of the time. He was studying mob lynching a lot of the time. And most of his studies, in fact, were concerning the people of the wrong ethnic group or the wrong color. So he was trying to help those people a lot. He was studying how mob lynchings happen with African-American populations in the 20th century. He was studying how the Middle East practices honor killings, and he had arguments about the genetic connectedness between relatives that increase or decrease the probability of an honor killing happening.
Mm-hmm.
So this guy is, in the most absolute sense of the word, feminist. No, this guy has dedicated most of his life.
Sure. No. I was talking about his concrete actions. From what I read and heard is that he personally was very sexist towards women. That doesn't mean that
Are we talking about the same person?
Yes, Michael Shermer.
No, I'm not talking about Michael Shermer. I'm talking about Michael Shermer's guest.
Okay. I thought you were talking about Michael Shermer. Okay.
No, he's the skeptic guy. No, I'm talking about he had a guest. I can just link you the video, and we can link the video in the description.
Okay. We can put it in the show notes. I was talking about Michael Shermer because it turns out that he was very bad at conferences with women, and there was like multiple women saying like, no, he's a real creep, like trying because he's quite old and he was like hitting on really young women and trying, you know, like not saying that this is anything illegal, just saying creep as in creepy, like I maybe sex is not the word I should have used, but from what I read that he was a huge creep, that's why I was surprised. But I mean, even if he did a lot of work on lynchings and you know, feminist work, that doesn't really excuse your personal, you know, personal way of conducting yourselves towards the other gender. Actually, recently, the president, like, just yesterday, I'm a member of the American Atheist Association, so just yesterday I got an email that the chairman, David Silverman, he actually resigned due to sexual harassment allegations. So I don't know what the hell is going on in the atheist community, but it seems like a lot of these people are, I don't know what's going on.
We need to delineate between hitting on somebody, raping somebody, slapping somebody in the ass, and all the gradients of assault.
Yes.
And we should not be throwing everybody that has made any kind of approach in the same basket.
I totally agree.
And
yeah.
We should not fire people because of it. If it is restricted by the law, they should be punished, for example, in rape.
No,
but if you're just hitting on somebody, that should be judged by the masses, but not taken action against.
Depends on the situation. You can absolutely fire someone. Imagine that you have a coworker who's hitting on every single female coworker in the workplace. After a while, you're just gonna be saying like, "Look, you're fired. You're creating a really bad environment. Like, these women told you to stop. You're not stopping. You're still, you know, hitting on them." I think that even just hitting on women would be enough to be fired if you're doing it persistently and you don't stop doing it. So it just depends on the situation.
You made a really good example. We have a victim. So there is this coworker and he's hitting on women, and some of the women that are hitting on him have told him to stop. They have made a complaint to the boss. That is an absolute legitimate reason for him to be fired. But for example, you have another situation, and I'm totally agreeing with you in this point. This is a done deal. You're absolutely right on this. I'm going to just describe another situation that is a bit more nuanced. For example, you have somebody that's hitting on a colleague. She rejects him, but she doesn't find his approach problematic. Okay. He's not a creep in her view.
Yes.
The observers from around take issue that he is approaching the woman, and they complain to the office and they complain to the boss. So in this case, you do not have a victim. The person that was approached didn't have a problem with the behavior.
I would say you still have a victim.
What?
If the other people, so if everyone else is feeling uncomfortable in their workplace that these people are flirting with each other, then that's a problem. Like, there's no victim in the victim sense, but there are people who are being slighted, you know. So imagine you walk into the office every day and you see these two people like just giggling and, you know, in one corner and like saying really, I don't know, some naughty stuff to each other. And you're gonna be like, exactly. No, this is not okay. This is like, we're in a workplace, so we need to take this seriously. So if that's not okay, then you can totally file a complaint. I mean, that's not...
I totally disagree with you. So I totally disagree with you, you because think, we're back to the age of religious dominance. Oh, look, they're kissing. Oh, look, they're dressing inappropriately. Oh, look, they're flirting. That's a sin. You just said that.
No. I'm saying like the professional workplace is professional. So if you're mixing social norms in the professional workplace, then that's reason for... Well, for complaining.
No, I'm saying that should be tolerated. In a free society, I think that should be tolerated.
No, but it's a company. First of all, they can do whatever they want because it's a company. But also, like, no. But this is a clear delineation. Like, you have professional things and personal things. Like, you're not gonna, I don't know. I don't have a better example than this. But, In any case, we can make two different companies and fire or not fire the people that do these things and see which company thrives more. Maybe it's going to be... Yes.
Okay, maybe I don't have a problem with the thing you're saying so much. Maybe I have a problem with the when there's not a victim and there's a Twitter mob raging or something on that sort. Maybe that's the more fundamental problem I have with people taking offense or taking issue about an event that they aren't personally involved in.
Okay.
That's where I have a bit more of a problem with.
No, but my point was very simple. Like, it doesn't have to be anything with another person. Like, for example, let's say you have a person who eats a banana very provocatively every day at work, and you can totally complain, you know, to management and be like, look, I mean, this is a workplace, and it's like, this guy is blowing the banana like a penis, so let's not have that at the workplace. So like, that's the management might disagree, might say like, no, you're making a big deal out of nothing. So I didn't say that this would automatically, you know, make it so that the person should stop whatever they're doing or even be fired. But like, you can totally complain if you want.
Okay. I'm going to agree with you on this. They should be sanctioned or fired on the basis of not respecting their professional restraints. They should not be sanctioned or fired on the basis of harassment.
Oh, I totally agree. Yes. I totally agree. That was my point. Like, if the other person does not feel harassed, of course they shouldn't be fired for harassment. But they could be fired for, like, not being professional at the workplace. That was my point with the flirting. Yes, that was my point. That's yes, fine. Of course not for harassment. Okay, so, no one's being harassed. Of course. I totally agree.
Okay.
Yes. So, you can't be fired for harassment if you didn't harass anybody. That's totally legitimate. I totally agree. Okay. So it was just a misunderstanding.
Is it harassment though if they make eye contact with you when they're blowing the banana?
Oh god, it might be. I guess we'll have to put that to a referendum. Yeah, that would be so funny. Imagine someone complaining and saying and talking to the manager and saying like, oh, you know, it wasn't harassment if he was not looking at me, but now that like he's making eye contact while he's blowing the banana, I feel really dirty. And then the manager imagine saying like, you know, yes, we'll take care of that. And imagine then like company wide email for 10,000 people. They're like, guys, we need you to vote on this. Like, does making eye contact while eating a banana harassment or not? And remember, you know, the results are gonna, you know, the consequences are going to be big. Someone's going to get fired, maybe.
If Jess is blowing the banana, is that a no-no? Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So let's get back. Let's get back on this. I want to talk about hypocrisy, if you don't have anything at the moment.
No, I don't actually. I wasn't really prepared with good examples in media manipulation. I think we can leave it for the next episode, maybe. if you have some more on one-on-one manipulation, go ahead.
We can open some of those subjects as well. They're very interesting. I just want to touch on hypocrisy a little bit.
Sure. First. Sure.
So everybody knows what hypocrisy is.
Yes, the Hippocratic Oath, right? The do no harm to... Yeah, I'm kidding.
Not exactly that one. I was talking about preaching one thing and acting differently.
Mm-hmm.
So there is an incongruence between the behavior and the statements.
Sure.
Hypocrisy is bad, but I wanted to touch upon a little bit why it happens. And this is a very interesting subject for me. I've heard this statement once and I really liked it. So, for example, you have the classical reason for hypocrisy, which is to manipulate. And we all know that there's a bad actor involved in all of this, and that's fine. We're going to put that aside. I'm just going to talk a little bit about unintentional hypocrisy. And
okay.
How does a person become a hypocrite while they're not observing it in themselves? They're not aware of it. So here's what happens. What part of the things that happen? So I'm going to attribute the wrong things that you do based on your character. And I'm going to, on the other hand, when I do those wrong things, I'm attributing those wrong things based on my circumstances.
Okay. Yeah, but that's the fundamental attribution fallacy. I forgot the name, but that's a very well-known fallacy. A bias, actually.
Exactly. So that's how hypocrisy happens. So what everybody else is doing, it's because of their personality. It's because of their character. When I'm doing something, it's because of my circumstances. And if we are not aware of this phenomena, we are exposed to being more hypocritical it's not a norm for that, than we should, I suppose, even though I don't like that word.
Yeah, I think that actually makes a lot of sense. You wouldn't say you're being hypocritical because you can just say that the circumstances excuse your behavior. That makes sense. That makes a lot of sense. I like your interpretation of it. But yeah, that's a well-known bias. Yeah, we never, when you're late, it's always, you know, oh, the car, you know, or this or that, or like,
exactly.
There was a lot of traffic. But when someone else is late, it's like, oh, they're just a late person. Like, they just like being late. So yeah, I totally agree.
They're just late. Or when you're cut off in traffic, the person cutting you off is a prick. And when you cut someone else off in traffic is because you're rushing.
Yeah, or you had a bad day, right? Or you can say like, no, I'm not an angry person. I just had a bad day. But when they do that, it's not because they have a bad day. You're just being an angry person all the time. Yeah, I totally agree. Yeah. actually, I tried to have a bet with a colleague that we have this, we have a person who's always late to all the classes. So I was like, you know, you want to bet like when he's going to be late or not? And then he said like, but he's always late. So we realized that you can't really bet like whether he's going to be late because he really is always late. So there's not much of a betting opportunity there. But yeah, I guess in that case, like you can really attribute that to be someone being a late person. There's an excuse for the first or a second time, but not really for the 10th time. I guess it depends on how often it occurs. So I'm saying like it might not be a bias if you know someone is late every time, like, so you can't really say that like, oh, it's the circumstances that you know, if you're trying to be unbiased, sometimes they, you know, sometimes someone is really just a person who is late all the time, and unfortunately.
Okay, I have a political one for you.
Oh, okay, shoot.
So I'm just going to talk about political assassination.
Okay.
Just a little bit. So this is when you dig through a person's history, and this is some figure in society,
mm-hmm.
or it can actually be interpersonal. Doesn't matter. It just can be two people disagreeing on some stuff.
Okay.
And you find their skeletons. You find their skeletons in their closet, and you say, okay, in the past, 10 years ago, you have done this one bad thing. And because you have done this one bad thing, you are a bad person. And because you are a bad person, that nobody should listen to your arguments. Mm-hmm. That's the classical political assassination. This has been done with Cenk Uygur, if you know, from the Young Turks.
Yeah, but I mean, to be fair, I don't even know what political assassination they've done to him, but I really don't like the guy, even not knowing anything about his skeletons.
It doesn't matter. I do not like the guy also. The question is, when Cenk Uygur puts up an argument, should I disregard the argument because he had some dark history, or should I face the argument?
No, they're just ad hominem or poisoning the well, basically saying that since the source of the argument is bad, the argument has to be bad as well. Yeah, I totally agree. That's not a good argument to be having in a conversation. So what was he being politically assassinated about?
Harassment. He was writing. And this is very interesting. This happened like 10 years ago, 15 years ago. I'm not sure about how much. No, so this is long in the past. And, they found some article that he wrote that he was just expressing how much of a young and horny guy he is. Okay. He was just, sharing how to be a baller, a player, or a pimp.
Oh my god!
So it's just smack talk with that people have on a daily basis. The mistake that he did was putting it in writing,
I guess. Yeah.
So because of that, he was removed from the board of the Justice Democrats.
Mm-hmm.
Because he lost this moral purity test. His political career, even though it was just starting, just went downhill. And this isn't something that I really see eye to eye with. Yes, maybe Cenk Uygur said some bad things in the past, but first of all, he said them in the past, and maybe there should be a pause in the reaction because some time has passed by.
Yeah, maybe there should be like a statute of limitations for things like that.
I mean, the thing with the statute of limitations and the expiry date of some offenses is in our court system for a reason. You know, or the expiry of crimes. I don't know how exactly to say.
Yeah, it's something like, 15, 20 years? I think it depends on the crime in the U.S. I'm not sure how it works.
Exactly. It depends on the crime. So I'm saying that the same principle should count in the social sphere and the political sphere as well. You have said something in your past, and we have probably said some stupid things when we were younger as well, and we're probably still going to keep on saying some stupid things. But we are maturing from day to day, and the goal isn't to be the best or the purest person. The goal is to be a better person than yesterday.
It's so true.
As long as you're not plateauing, you're fine. And Cenk has been improving throughout the years, and he's shown that in his conduct. And he's also had his own political agenda that I may not agree with. In fact, I probably don't agree with most of it. But I'm not going to disregard his arguments based on his past. I'm going to disregard his arguments based on the merit of those arguments. Mm-hmm. And this is why I take offense when people have applied that moral purity test to a 10-year-old case.
Yeah. Yes. I mean, I agree. It's I guess the only problem is from a perspective, you know, from a functional perspective, or let's just say from a practical perspective, right? It's if you don't remove him, then people are not able in general to differentiate those two things that easily. So for example, you know, if in their head he's just a sexual harasser, it's just something that he'll be associated with, and people are not even going to listen to him. So, you know, the whole organization is going to lose credibility, even if they know that it's the wrong thing to do.
No, that's not a legitimate claim. He has moved on, he has improved, and he has, in fact, apologized for it. And after 10 years, that should count for something. His apology should count for something. if somebody says that after 10 years, an apology for a victimless crime is not enough, I have a problem with that somebody. I do not have a problem with
gender. I agree. The problem is the somebody. Yeah, I agree. The somebody is a lot of people who are, you know, who can't really realize that you can say sorry and then move on. Yes, I agree. I'm not sure how we can fix that. I guess you're saying that we should fight these people other and not fire him, which I guess I agree with. I mean, I really wouldn't say yes to firing him just for some victimless crime like you mentioned, for sure.
Absolutely not. Yes.
Yeah. There was a similar incident recently with a Democrat majority leader. No, he was not a majority leader. He was just a senator. Sorry. Right. The guy was. I forgot his name. He was
Chuck Schumer. Who?
No, not Schumer. No. He's the leader. No, the guy who was a comedian. Al Franken.
Al Franken. Yeah. Al Franken. Yeah. He slapped some asses. Yeah, that's the guy.
No. He didn't. He had a picture where he did like, you know, air boob touching. Like I think he was touching the boobs. He was just like pretending to be touching the boobs of someone. And of course, that's horrible.
It's not a crime to be horny. What the fuck?
No. I mean, it's really disrespectful, but he did apologize for it. And the person did say, like, okay, accept your apology. And she didn't call for him to get fired, but she still stepped down after. I was like, why? Like, this was really not that big of a deal because he apologized. If he didn't apologize, I would say like, no. You can't, you know, I don't want him to set an example that you can be an asshole and succeed. Like, he should apologize. And he did. And I was like, wait, he's stepping down anyway? So that was, I agree that, you know, his career shouldn't be ruined by something like some stupid prank or something. It really was not, didn't have big consequences. And he did apologize. So yeah, I agree.
Would you, I mean, I completely agree with you on this situation. I'm just going to put up a variant of the situation and get your opinion on it.
In case he didn't apologize?
in case he didn't apologize and if he is friends or has some sort of a flirtatious relationship with the other party. So, for example, I'm going to make an air boob touching or whatever you called it with somebody.
Oh, no, that's totally okay. Very good friend. No. But if the friend is a good friend, they wouldn't be complaining, right? So, like, we're presuming that the friend is not complaining, right?
Yes.
Yes, for sure, for sure. No. This is not bad at all. Like, it's just so this would be like other people, exactly, like the victimless harassment that we talked about before. Yes, I totally agree. We're on the same page for this because, yeah, there's no reason. Letting bad happen, like, he doesn't have to apologize for something that might offend some other people or something. Yeah, I agree with you.
Okay.
Yeah.
Great. I have one more, and this is just an example. Mm-hmm. I wrote this down back when we were talking about the people surveying you and asking you for money.
Sure.
This is called recruitment technique, and I just wrote it down for later. When you were talking, I was reminded of it, and I think it's really cool, so I want to share it again. Mm-hmm. So this was shared by some kind of this was practiced by some kind of a Christian cult in the States. I have no idea what kind of a cult it was. And the way that they would initiate conversation was something along the lines of this. A small boy, maybe 10 to 15 years old, would approach a woman, younger or older, doesn't really matter. And he would say something along the lines of this. Hello, you look like a very nice lady, but you are a sinner and you will burn into the eternity of hell forever and ever. So this immediately would get either two responses. If it was a younger lady, she would turn around and be a little bit perplexed and maybe start a conversation with the boy, trying to dissuade him of his extreme beliefs, mm-hmm. in which he would introduce him to his mother, who was the recruiter for the cult, and then the emotional manipulation would start. Or if it was an older woman, she would turn around and slap the kid, in which case he would also introduce her to his mother, in which she would be blackmailed into having a conversation. Because, you know, if you slap somebody, you can get you can get the police at your door. So they would blackmail the person. Look, mom, she slapped me, and the mom is going to come and she's going to say, okay, well, we can either go to the police or you can have coffee with me and talk for 15 minutes.
Oh, that's really insidious. Yeah,
it is. It is. And this was trained, you know, they used a similar line every time.
Oh, that's horrible.
Something
yeah.
like Jehovah's Witness, but really bad.
Yeah, but this is not Jehovah's Witnesses, right? Something.
No, it's some other smaller kind of thing. It's really like 30 years ago. The example was really old, but I really liked it. You know,
yeah.
He starts off nice. He's saying, "Oh, hello, you look like a really nice and beautiful lady, but you're gonna burn in hell for all eternity."
Yeah.
She's like, "Oh my god!"
So this was one of the smaller cults, not the big cults that we call a religion.
Yeah, one of those. Exactly, because, one of those.
Yeah, I don't know why we call one thing a cult and the other religion, where the only difference is the number of followers. You know, once like a lot of people believe the bullshit, now you can't really call it a cult because people are going to get offended that they're such big idiots to have fallen for a cult. So now it's a religion. I feel like that's the reason we have two different names.
There is a difference. And here is probably the difference. With the increase in followers, there is lesser room for manipulating the followers. The positions, the rituals have all been dispersed among the population, and they have become, in a way, socially acceptable. While if you're talking about a small following, if you're talking about a small cult, then the probability of this being some sort of a cult of personality, and the probability of the small following that the cult has to be totally manipulated out of their wealth and mental well-being is a lot higher. So you can say that even though religion is as it is, you can still find some functional aspects, and therefore it should be differentiated from cults as such. Now, you may not agree with the aspects, you may not agree with what they are preaching, but there is this right of religion that people have, and if they so choose to follow a certain religion, then I suppose that's fine, as long as there is also a right from religion. Mm-hmm. So you can follow whatever kind of sect you want, whatever kind of religion you want, but you should also be free to distance yourself from it. So, for example, if a religion is way too authoritarian, I would consider it really problematic compared to some religion that you can pull away from easily or with less consequences.
Yeah, I mean, I was kind of tongue-in-cheek. I know that, you know, when we say cults, we really mean the cults that are very, yes, authoritarian, that are hard to get out of, and of course have really weird rituals, whereas religion gets diluted, as you said. So yes, I was kind of more a joke, but I do agree that there is a kind of a difference. But my point was that people don't take cults seriously because, you know, like, oh, those things that they believe in, like those rituals, they are ridiculous. But like the rituals from the major religions, they are totally fine, even though they are, honestly, some of them are just as ridiculous, you know. Like, I think in Catholicism, you know, you're eating some bread and you're saying like, oh, this is the body of Jesus that I'm imbibing or something.
Here's the difference. So, people can choose to follow their religion metaphorically, as in they can cherry pick the aspects that are incongruent with their moral values and follow those and disregard the body of Jesus and stuff like that, or they can, you know, choose to follow their religion literally, in which case they follow it to the letter to the extent that they have read it. So this is another problem. You know, how much are you familiar with your religion? But putting that aside, there's a different problem with religions and cults. So into a religion, you are usually you're born in it. People may change religions like once or twice max in their lives, but usually people are born into their religion. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of part of your upbringing. I'm not saying that this is a good thing. I'm just saying that this is less harmful. Yeah. In a cult, in comparison with cults, cults usually prey on what we call as what we call vulnerable groups. So, for example, there was an unanticipated tragic event in your life. You are the best candidate to go into a cult at that yeah. moment. Because in those events, all the rationalities, even in the smartest people, can fall and crumble just a little bit. And that's just enough so that the cult leader or the cult recruiter can call you in to their organization.
Yeah. That's true. Yeah.
All right. Cool. So I think we should, you know, slowly wrap up.
Yeah, yeah. I think we covered a lot of ground today. And I guess we can leave some the more like media manipulation for next time with all these scandals that are going on. So tune in next time to hear about the Russian meddling. And I'm kidding. That's really not a big deal. But we can talk about
that's that. That's going to be a big deal if you start that, you know that.
Yeah. We can talk about the recent Facebook scandal with Cambridge Analytica. And
we can talk about Facebook. Yeah, that's going to be fun. Let's not start it.
We can definitely do that.
So it was a pleasure speaking to you again.
Yeah, likewise.
And to all of us, to all of the people that have just discovered the channel, we are really thankful if you made it to the end. We would appreciate some comments as to how we can improve this whole thing, and we hope to see you again.
Yeah, we relay discussions, so feel free to like or dislike if you don't like us, and above all, leave a comment if you want to get into the details of something that we spoke about. Oh, yeah, we're looking forward to it.
Okay, goodbye. Okay.
Bye-bye.